supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Juror deliberations in Bill Cosby's sexual assault trial have now lasted about as long as the prosecution and defense cases combined. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Joining me from outside the courthouse in Norristown, WHYY's Laura Benshoff. Laura, jurors have smashed through the 40-hour work week. What are the highlights today?
Hey there, Dave. Well, highlights today were the jury asked a few more questions. They've asked to rehear tons of testimony that they heard last week. Today they asked to hear some of the accuser's mother's testimony about a time she confronted Bill Cosby. They've asked to hear about phone calls exchanged between the complainant, Andrea Constand, and Bill Cosby after the alleged assault. And I think a real highlight today was some things came to a head between the defense and the judge. The defense inside the courthouse and outside has been really pushing for a mistrial, both with motions filed by Cosby's lawyers saying this has gone on long enough. You know, we think that the jury's too deadlocked. You should end the trial now. And Cosby's spokesman has been saying as much and criticizing the judge repeatedly. So the judge said, hey, you guys are insinuating that I'm doing something wrong here, but there's nothing in Pennsylvania law that says I shouldn't let the jury deliberate as long as they feel they need to. And they've been very productive. They've been smiling today at each other. They've been asking a lot of questions. So he says, this is deliberation. This is what it looks like. It needs to go on.
Though conversely, when is it appropriate for the judge to say, you obviously can't get past this. It is time to declare a mistrial?
Well, you know, he's not supposed to be the one to bring that up. The jury has to come to him and say, look, we're at an impasse. And they did that once already, a couple days ago, at about 11 in the morning. They'd been going for, you know, dozens of hours already. And, you know, they said, we're deadlocked. And he read something called the Allen Charge, which is supposed to sort of remind them that it's their duty to try as hard as they can to make a decision, to reach a consensus. And since then, you know, they've really seemed to be deliberating at a good clip. Like I said, asking a lot of questions. They've gone from acting very tense as a group to seeming looser and smiling at each other. And so until they come to the judge and say, you know, we're really not making any progress on one or all three counts, he's not going to be the one to introduce that possibility.
Might this extend into the weekend, or if there's no progress by, say, 9 o'clock tonight, it would resume again on Monday?
That's a great question, and I wish I knew the answer to it. You know, the jury's sequestered, so there's a good possibility the judge will just have them kind of push through the weekend, because any downtime they have could sort of tempt them to look at news that they're not supposed to, or to try to talk each other into something. But, you know, at this point, they've said nothing about the possibility. It's purely speculation on you know, courthouse employee and reporter's parts, but it seems like it's a good possibility for sure.
That the jurors seem energized, how might you assess the mood and temperament of the attorneys, the judge, Bill Cosby?
Well, you know, I can only share what I see. And like I said, the jury seemed a little bit looser. They seem to be, you know, communicating more with body language and commiserating a little bit more in the jury box and open court. You know, the lawyers, for the most part, are stoic, although, like I said, Cosby's defense team made another impassioned plea. This was their sixth plea for a mistrial today. And, you know, the lead defense attorney, Brian McMonagle, basically said this has gone on long enough. They've now deliberated more than 40 hours. This is longer than the trial itself, or nearly as long as the actual trial testimony itself. And, you know, he's a big showman, so he made, you know, yelling noises and sort of kind of got into it with the judge. And the judge honestly seems very tired and rather annoyed by that. You know, they're impugning his judgment. They're saying he's not doing his job. And you could kind of tell he was getting snappy and he didn't want to hear it anymore.
Laura, should the defense ultimately get its wish, what are the implications of a mistrial?
Well, so one of the things that got explained to Cosby today was just that, you know, with all of the people who are working for him on this case, his spokesman and his lawyer pushing for one, the judge asked him, are you sure you know what this means? Because it means he could go through the whole thing over again. You know, it's up to the prosecutors if they would want to bring charges again in the event of a mistrial, in the event the jury can't reach a decision this time. But Cosby, if that happens, is still faced with the prospect of a repeat. And this has been an 18-month slog, so I don't imagine that that's a very pleasant idea, but that's what's on the table.
WHYY's Laura Benshoff reporting. If we get more news in the evening, we will report that to our listeners. In other news today, after 4 years of waiting, teachers in the School District of Philadelphia may finally be getting a new contract. The district and the city's teachers union announced today they've reached a tentative deal on a new contract running through 2020. Details from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
This announcement doesn't mean the deal is done, but it's closer than ever. Teachers in Philly have worked without a contract since 2013 and haven't had a raise since 2012. The stalemate frustrated teachers and administrators alike, casting a cloud over the district even as its finances and management stabilized. Many Philly teachers threatened to leave the district if the two sides couldn't reach a deal. Neither side is releasing details on the new agreement yet, but it almost certainly will contain raises. Before the deal becomes final, union members will have a vote to ratify the pact. If they do, the contract will go to Philadelphia's School Reform Commission for a final vote. It's unknown how this deal will impact district finances, which are already shaky. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
The Trump administration announced late last night that it will continue the DACA program that temporarily shields from deportation immigrants who came to the United States illegally as children. Adrian, who does not want his full name used, is a legal assistant in the Philadelphia area who's benefited from DACA. He's relieved to hear the program is not going away, but he says he's frustrated that the parents of dreamers like him are still at risk of being deported.
I don't think it's morally right for, you know, for the president to differentiate us and them. You know, we're all immigrants here and we're all hardworking.
Daisy Romero is another dreamer covered by DACA who's concerned about what'll happen to immigrant families, especially her own. Her parents are unauthorized and live in Texas with her siblings. She graduated from the University of Pennsylvania last month and remembers worrying about deportation during her midterms.
I recall being, you know, going through finals, going through midterms when the Austin raids were happening in Texas and feeling so much fear and anxiety, and I cried and I didn't know what to do, or I had to talk to my parents about the fact that there is a possibility of deportations happening in our city.
Romero's also glad the program will continue, though she expresses concerns about the safety of immigrants still unprotected. Now that she's out of school, she says she hopes to find work advocating to change immigration policy. Continuing coverage of the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 elections is dominating the news. Let's learn if President Donald Trump's job approval rating is a potential casualty of that focus. More from Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, the president has complained that all the focus on the investigation is keeping the attention away from his agenda. Is it possible that that accounts for his slide in job approval rating?
It's possible. I would be very cautious, however, in saying how much of a slide it is. A lot of people think there's a lot of movement in his approval rating, but one of the remarkable things about Donald Trump since he took office in January is how stable his approval ratings have been. We just did the calculations. His average has been 40% approval rating since January 20th, and he will edge up from that maybe 2 or 3 points at times. He will edge down from that maybe 2 or 3 points at times. But we don't see the kind of dramatic movement that we saw, say, for Bill Clinton in 1993 in his first term. Right now, we are seeing Trump's approval rating right in that 37-36% range. So it is at the lower end of the range that we've monitored for Trump. But not highly unusual. It's been this low before, back in May, for example, and even in March. So I would be very hesitant to say that we're seeing a dramatic drop-off in Trump's already low approval rating. It's just low and kind of moves around, but he's got a very core base of supporters that don't seem to change their mind.
Though, as we've touched on repeatedly, it's very unusual that a president doesn't enjoy at least some semblance of a honeymoon period.
That's the remarkable thing about Donald Trump, is that when he came into office, his approval rating was in the 40% range. Typically, they're at least in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s. The only other president in June in our history, newly elected President Dave, whose approval rating was below 50%, was the aforementioned Bill Clinton. He actually had a 37% approval rating in mid-June back in 1993, and that was down from being up in the 50%. It actually rose back up to the 50% range a couple of months later. But other than that, every president in June, after being first elected, had approval ratings at the 50% level or higher. So Trump's clearly below average.
Is Bill Clinton among the cohort of former chief executives who get a bounce after they leave office?
Bill Clinton's ratings, his favorable rating, which is what we looked at, has been up and down.
How about other former presidents? Is there the same level of volatility once they leave office?
There is. Although right now, I have to say that both Barack Obama and George W. Bush are enjoying very favorable images in the eyes of the American public. We just updated this within the last week. Barack Obama right now a 63% favorable image, and George W. Bush has a 59% positive rating, favorable rating, and a 37% unfavorable rating. So both of these immediate two past presidents before Trump looking pretty good to the average American.
Frank, here's something else that's pretty good. Stock market's up. Unemployment is down. Are Americans more positive about the way things are going in the country these days?
No, they're not. 73% of Americans, when we updated this just recently, our June update, say they are dissatisfied with the way things are going. And that's actually lower than it's been any other month this year so far, Dave. That leaves just about 24% of Americans who say they're satisfied. And you named it. I mean, economically, the country's looking pretty good right now for the kind of measures you talked about. And yet there's this dissatisfaction, I would say, this anxiety out there on the part of the average American. So we ask, what's the most important problem facing the country? That's a good clue, which we just ask. And we found that it's the government. And that includes politicians, includes Donald Trump, includes Congress. That's up this month. In fact, it's as high, the percent who say government, politicians are the biggest problem facing the country. That's higher than in any other point since the government shut down back in the fall of 2013.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Scientists have found that those who live close to fracking are more likely to experience health problems. This has fueled speculation that the hydraulic fracturing process is to blame. One researcher thinks the problem might have nothing to do with fracking, but something we see so often, we hardly ever notice it. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains.
Mike McCauley is a West Virginia University professor of environmental health. When he started to study fracking a few years ago, he began hearing stories from residents and medical professionals in fracking areas of children getting asthma and an increase in cardiovascular disease.
That's usually considered a sentinel event when people start saying, well, I'm noticing this upswing. So it's not proof positive, but it's something to make you sit up and take a closer look.
These anecdotes were followed by studies showing similar trends, like an uptick in hospitalization, asthma, and premature birth in fracking areas. But these studies couldn't explain why these effects were happening. McCauley knew some of these symptoms were common in people exposed to diesel fumes. He thought these health impacts may be tied to diesel emissions at the well pad itself, from equipment used to drill and frack for natural gas. Then a few years ago, he had an epiphany, standing in a town in northeastern Pennsylvania during the height of the fracking boom.
And about every 45 seconds, there was a heavy-duty diesel truck came by, and it didn't matter what the time of day was.
Diesel engines emit a large number of tiny masses called ultrafine particles. These particles are so small they can fit inside the pores of a human cell, McCauley says. And once inside a cell, can cause problems. Diesel pollution is linked to heart and lung disease and cancer. McCauley began testing the air along roads near fracking sites in West Virginia on a grant from the Department of Energy. And he saw concentrations of ultrafine particles similar to what you would find in a big city. He says that makes sense since each gas well requires between 4,000 and 6,000 truck trips to haul equipment and material to a well site.
Here comes one.
In Scenery Hill, Washington County, Lois Bauer Bjornson can tell a truck coming up the road the next valley over. Bauer Bjornson and her husband moved to Washington County from Pittsburgh 13 years ago with their young children. She became an environmental activist after watching 33 wells get built within a 3-mile radius of her house. Trucks rumble by on the state highway she lives on. She knew the road had traffic when she moved in 13 years ago, but she said it wasn't like this.
When it was busy, it would be in the mornings and the evenings for like what we call rush hour, but not what it is now. It's endless, and you've got massive trucks, whether they're residual waste trucks, freshwater trucks, the crane trucks, just everything you need for a well pad is trucked in.
Now, the gas industry has tried to reduce truck traffic by piping more water into their well sites rather than using trucks. And it's converting some vehicles and equipment to run off natural gas instead of diesel. Still, diesel trucks remain indispensable for the industry. The State Department of Environmental Protection has limits on truck idling and says air quality in drilling regions meets federal standards. But the air monitors that the agency uses aren't measuring those ultrafine particles scientist Mike McCauley is so concerned about. McCauley says we could find public health impacts farther away from well pads than previously thought, though he says it's understandable that attention has been focused on well sites.
It's easy to make the blame game if your kids are sick or your grandparents are sick or you're not feeling so well yourself, to say, it must be that well pad because I can see that well pad and it's got its lights on all night long and we should be going after that. In fact, ignore the truck that's rumbling past your house.
Using satellite data and lab analysis, McCauley is now testing his hypothesis. Those results could come out in the next year or two. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Philadelphia's innovative alternative court for repeat prostitution offenders is now the subject of a play in Malvern. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on the premiere of Project Dawn.
The Project Dawn program began in 2010 to offer those charged with prostitution social services and rehabilitation to help guide repeat offenders out of the sex trade. Playwright Karen Hartman saw this as a courtroom drama of a different kind.
In a court drama, there's a lot of, is somebody innocent or guilty? But in the Project Dawn court, the facts of what happened are not in dispute. All the women plead no contest in order to enter this treatment court. So the question is, what happens from here?
Your Honor, this is Ms. Lola Vargas.
Hartman was commissioned to write the play, Project Dawn, by People's Light and Theater Company in Malvern, Pennsylvania. The drama follows seven women through a court-monitored treatment program which can take more than a year of drug rehabilitation, trauma counseling, halfway housing, and vocational training. If the women make it through, the charges may be dropped and their records expunged. The playwright was originally researching a play about the Underground Railroad and a slave's psychological transformation from being property to being a person. Hartman found a similar transformation happening in Project Dawn.
It's hard to explain, but the staff treats the women like people and not numbers. They talk about them like people and not statistics.
Project Dawn, the play, has been selected for a rolling premiere. That means after its debut at People's Light and Theater, it will be produced in Atlanta and Kansas City. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And finally this evening, poetry fans gathered today at 20th and Delancey Place in Philadelphia to celebrate the James Joyce epic Ulysses. Philadelphia's poet laureate Yolanda Wisher read two pages from the book, which many consider to be a masterpiece.
But you were delighted when Esther Oswald's shoe went on you, girl I knew in Paris. Tien quel petit pied, staunch friend, a brother's soul, wild love that dare not speak its name.
For the past 20 years, the Rosenbach Museum has taken Ulysses to the streets as part of Bloomsday, a worldwide celebration of Joyce. The event lasts 8 hours with more than 70 readers. Edward G. Pettit is the program coordinator for the event.
But really, an event like this recreates it with all these different voices bringing all these passages to life. So that's what so excites me about that, is that it is the novel come to life.
And throughout the day, musicians also sang poems featured in Ulysses.
Love's bitter mist
That's Abla Lynn Hamza singing an excerpt of William Butler Yeats' Who Goes with Fergus. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. We had help this week from our intern, Kate Summers. At the helm, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations, and our News Director is Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.